Joe.
Hi.
Joe, I want you to tell the listener at home what we're watching today.
What we're watching today, Nathan, is widely considered to be one of the best episodes of Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
Widely considered to be one of the best episodes of Star Trek. Mm-hmm. I took a good look at Wikipedia before coming onto this recording, and it cited literally 50 sources. It's on all the lists, the top 10 lists. It's, all those great Star Trek experts out there that have brought out books. It's on all of their lists as well. Today, we are going to be watching and talking about In the Pale Moonlight.
I think it is pretty good, but I still maintain it's not as good as Take Me Out to the Holosuite.
God's sake. I think you are unique in that opinion, you know. I've got a question for you before. I've got some trivia, but I do have a question for you. Okay. How do you feel about the Dominion War Arc? Because I don't actually know how you feel about that.
I think it's interesting to do that, and I can see why they did do it, because Star Trek The Next Generation had been very staid, and they had basically kind of aped that at the beginning of Deep Space Nine. You know, it was a Star Trek spin-off, and they were basically doing the same sort of thing. And I do think that they do it well, and I think it enables them to go places that other Star Treks hadn't been, and I'm always here for that. I think that Star Trek should be doing things that are new rather than just sort of warming over old Star Trek The Next Generation plots like Voyager sometimes does.
Well, and DS9 was guilty of that in its first couple
of
years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I also think that probably it's the only 90s Trek that could have sustained it, because the characters are so strong and there are so many of them. And it also gives, you know, the Alpha Quadrant a kind of feel to it, a structure. We get a kind of sense of what the galaxy's like. And I think all of that stuff is good. I do have reservations about it a bit, though. And one of the reasons is that, for me, Star Trek has a kind of mission to show a future for humanity that's better. And we do win, obviously, yeah, the Dominion War, and it's all fine. But sometimes I think it strays into territory that's probably best left to Battlestar Galactica. And maybe even this week's episode does that a little bit.
I mean, I agree with you and I disagree with you. I agree with you in that, you know, Star Trek kind of has a mission statement to show a better future. But I think maybe that's a little bit boring at times. Yeah. And I think this is really interesting to watch because it's full of drama and action and suspense and great character work. But it may be like those people that are out there waving placards saying that this is betraying the Roddenberry ideal, whatever that might be. Maybe they've got a point, you know, the Mary Whitehouses of the Star Trek universe.
Yeah, I think, you know, like the Roddenberry ideal is always something that's kind of read back into Star Trek. I don't think it's really particularly present in the original series.
No, well, from what I was reading, a lot of the original series was influenced by Gene Coon rather than Gene Roddenberry.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think the kind of the purest Gene Roddenberry that we get is when The Next Generation was launched. That's when he had the greatest sort of creative control. And look at it. Justice, like, you know, Justice and Hide and Q and all that nonsense. Like, really?
Yeah, Code of Honor.
Would we have had 21 seasons of 90s Trek if it had continued in that vein? But also think as well, with DS9, they deliberately set it in a static location. And they said, you know, we want Star Trek to have consequences. That was part of the remit of this show, was that they couldn't just warp away from the problems that were occurring where they're set. So I think to get here was kind of inevitable, because otherwise what can you do with a static setting?
Yeah, yeah. You can't just send two characters off in a runabout every week to a different moon of Bajor or something. Like, it always needed to go somewhere else. And I think it does that really well. And it is the first Star Trek to experiment with proper serialized storytelling. Yeah. And I think it does a really good job of that. And in that context, I think this episode is really, really interesting. The approach that it takes, the way it's structured, like, I'm really on board with it.
And I do think, like, generally speaking, a show is either like arc-based, so it's like Picard, which is like I said before, chapters in a novel that's so serialized that you can't really dip in and out, or you're like a procedural, like The Next Generation. And most episodes, pretty much all of them, are standalone. And at the beginning, the problem's there. At the end, the problem's solved. And then off we go again. DS9 is quite unusual in that it absolutely has standalone episodes and a lot of them. But it does have this arc running through it as well, quite smartly as well. And I think come series six, that's the point where six and seven is where the arc is like heaviest and it has the most influence on every single episode. Like, you look at six, there is a Dominion reference, or it feeds into the main arc in some way, every single episode, but they still feel like individual pieces of drama in their own right, you know? And there's still space for one little ship and the Magnificent Ferengi. Take me out to the holosuite, bada bing, bada bang, you know, and things like that.
Yeah, I think that that's where Discovery actually lands, you know, 30 years later, is basically standalone stories, but with an ongoing arc, an arc that comes to a head at the mid-season break, which is actually where we are in Discovery Series 4 as we record
this. Astonishing, really. I don't like it more than I do, isn't it, Rick?
But I think that that means that Deep Space Nine actually hits on a more kind of mature and interesting way of telling a story by having a series of events that happen to a known group of people that are some way sort of consistent. You know how Lower Decks always makes fun of the fact that, you know, this week someone's been taken over by an alien, and this week, you know, a godlike entity is attacking us or whatever, and our
the
lives
best
are ridiculous.
One was where I can't remember, the character was convinced that someone was under the influence and was going through every single Trek cliche imaginable to try and expose them.
Oh,
it was so funny.
No, it was Mariner trying to explain why Boimler had a girlfriend and, like, she burned through all of these stupid Star Trek premises. And, you know, like, Deep Space Nine does do stupid Star Trek premises. It absolutely does. But I do like what they attempt here.
And so very quickly before we go in, I just want to say this episode initially was very different. I've been reading the Deep Space Nine Companion, and initially this was a Jake Sisko episode, right?
Oh.
And he was, you know, full-on reporter, Jake Sisko, for Starfleet News or whatever he writes for. And he discovers the plot to bring the Romulans into the war, and essentially he has to decide whether to print and expose his father or not. That was like the basic premise of the story. And Ron Moore says when they were hashing this out, because this is very much a writer's room, it might have Michael Taylor's name on the script, but like the final polish of this was written by Ron Moore as ever, probably while the dialogue's so good. That they just couldn't find a convincing way to have Jake and Sisko in conflict like this. And they just didn't want to go there, you know?
Yeah, that's it. That was what I was just thinking. Who wants to see that? Like, one of the great strengths of the show is the relationship between those two men. And I think that there is a moment in this episode as it lands that has conflict between two of the regulars that I don't buy at all.
You're not talking about the bit between Bashir and Sisko, are you?
Yeah.
I fucking love that scene. Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. I think it's a good scene, but it just doesn't fit, you know, with the established relationship between them. And obviously there's no consequences, which is another interesting choice that this episode makes, and a good choice. I like it a lot.
Well, and the other good choice they make is instead of Jake, they bring in Garak. And well, yeah, that's why this is amazing, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, exactly. Shall we?
Yeah, I think we should. So I'm queued up at the beginning and I am ready to press play. So I'll count us in.
Do so.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And we're off.
Now, I very much like this framing device because I feel like Sisko is only talking to me. No one else in the audience.
Well, I actually think that there are some shots where, like this shot here, where he's shot from the side, I would actually prefer him to be speaking to the audience because the conceit that he's doing a personal log in order to hash things out isn't really very convincing. Like, it's not realistic. It's a storytelling device, and I think that they were reluctant to lean into that as much as they should have. I think that having him just tell the audience what happened, I mean, that sets this episode apart because this episode is surprisingly distinctive. Like, it's the only Star Trek episode anything like this. And I think telling this story with that kind of narrative conceit is super interesting.
Makes it even more unique, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, as well, yeah. Like, you know, skipping right to the end, you know, the rapport that he makes doesn't exist, does it? So the only people that are ever privy to this conversation are us watching
the audience.
And I really love that.
Yeah, I mean, he basically deletes the episode at the end.
But also as well, so if this is him telling us or the rapport a story, is this a reliable story then? Is what we're seeing what actually happened? Because essentially we're seeing flashbacks as told by him.
Well, I think it is. I don't think Star Trek really does the unreliable narrator and certainly wouldn't make Sisko the unreliable narrator. So
they did it once deliberately. Do you remember there's Matter of Perspective in TNG where they had everyone tell us? Yeah. I don't think they did it very well, but they tried.
No. Yeah. I actually don't mind that episode, I have to say.
Grim is this that they all go in and have a look at a list once a week to see who's done. I mean, I get it. Like, you would want to know if somebody that you love or a friend of yours has been murdered. But the inference is that there is just a wave of murder occurring at the moment. You know, war is hell.
Look at Jadzia. Jadzia is usually so sort of chill and nothing kind of stresses her. And she's super hard-faced here and she's super angry about the fact that the Romulans are allowing the Dominion to do this, like to make the Cairo disappear. And she claims it's happened hundreds of times. I do love this setup. Really, someone should bring the Romulans into the war.
Okay.
Oh, suddenly I have an idea.
This is the biggest problem with Deep Space Nine right now, and it's because they don't trust the audience to keep up, right?
Yeah.
So in a minute, there's an info dump where Jadzia goes, you know, they are our allies, and why would they get involved? And it's like regurgitating information that we as regular viewers of this show know, but someone coming in would need to know in order for this episode to work. And DS9 is guilty of this a fair amount, and they tend to get away with it, but sometimes it's a bit clunky.
Well, I mean, the way that modern Star Trek avoids that is with the previously on Star Trek, which is not part of the narrative. And I think that that's something we've learned works.
Season 7, you'll notice over half the episodes of Season 7 have previously on. So they get a lot. So they've kind of figured it out by then, you know. And in that in sort of last 10 episodes, where it's one long narrative, they've got to do it. Otherwise, you're where the hell are we, you know?
Yeah. But that's a good decision rather than having it part of the drama where people are explaining their recent history to each other. So we're doing the opening credits again. How do we feel about them? Do we still feel the same?
I'll tell you what I feel about very strongly, and that's that lovely little man who goes flying through space with the... Oh, sorry. My favourite bit of the title sequence. And I know you said you quite like this. I mean, you know, I'm the biggest DS man in the world, but this is a bit dull, this title sequence.
Yeah, they can't break away from their original premise, which is that this is a outpost in the, you know, far away where nothing very much happens. So you fling a few more spaceships on there, starting with Series 4. And, of course, we do need to make the point that Kurtzman Trek has vastly better title sequences for all of its shows than...
It does. Yeah. I will not disagree. I want to quickly have a moment to talk about Avery Brooks as an actor, because I think he brings something incredibly distinct to DS9. He's what I call a dangerous actor, because I think he's very accomplished, but sometimes he can tip over into the point of a few moments where I'm just like, oh no, like, you know, he goes for it. He absolutely goes for it. And usually that means the results are surprising and really engaging. And occasionally he goes over a cliff, you know, and just goes a bit over the top, and it's not great. But I always want to watch him. I'm always drawn to him.
I've been thinking, and I don't know whether it's true, like, he's super reserved most of the time, and particularly early on. And there is a point in this episode where he kind of loses it, and he's losing it when he's talking to us, when he's talking to camera. And I'm not sure it's convincing psychologically. You know, like, I don't think
it's... You're not talking about the bit where he's like, people are dying out there
every day.
Worlds are struggling for their freedom. I love but that scene.
Him delivering it is so watchable. And I think that sometimes he goes for what's entertaining rather than what's psychologically real, like what the drama needs. You know, it's not sort of Stanislavski or anything. He's not being a method actor. He's doing what English actors were doing at the time, which is conveying information to the audience through their performance rather than trying to mimic being a real person. And I think it really works. I think he's got a great voice. He's dangerous.
Yeah.
He's passionate.
Like the word edgy is bounded around a bit too much, I think, but there are moments where he is a little edgy. I think it's because he's physically imposing. So there's moments where he shoves, but like the bit in this with Tolar, where he shoves him against the wall and he's like, you know, and I'll send you back to the Klingon Empire and tell them to take their time while they execute you.
Yeah.
You know, you're like, oh my God, I would not want you to be my boss, all right?
I wonder why he does that. We'll get there, I think. I really quite like the scene that we just talked through, which is Jadzia pretending to be a Romulan.
Oh my God, Terry Farrell.
Of an info dump.
When he says to her, you'd be a great Romulan, I'm like, yes, she would.
Yeah, she's really good.
It's amazing. Oh my God, here he is, Andrew Robinson as Garak. Okay. Look, we've talked about MVPs before. He's one of the MVPs of DS9. There are so many great actors involved in this show. But as an example of the stunning semi-regular cast, I mean, he's just so good.
Yeah.
I don't even think this is his best episode. And it's a great episode for him.
Is it a Ronald Moore thing? Like, this sort of large regular cast, like, you're stuck with the people in the opening credits. You know, the people who are originally cast. No. But you have the opportunity then, if you decide, I guess it's what The Simpsons did. You know, they took characters from like a single episode and just made them regulars because they thought they worked or they were funny. Yeah. And Moore runs the show. He's not, you know, J. Michael Straczynski, who has a 14-year plan. Like, he looks at the show as it's happening, decides what works, and then goes, absolutely, let's have more of that.
I mean, I'd say it's more Ira Bear that's kind of in full creative control. But they were like a band of brothers, and, you know, they love the show. But they, as good as admit, they improvised. So if things worked, like Garak's in one episode in Series 1, the second episode, past prologue, he doesn't appear again until early season 2. Then he has a couple of appearances towards the end of 2. And then from 3 onwards, that's when he becomes, and they're like, this guy is amazing. We can write him really well. Like, he's enigmatic, he's mysterious, he's interesting. let's keep using
and he's camp, he's funny, and oh, you know, God. Like
that first scene he has with Bashir, where he's like, I'm so pleased to have met such an interesting friend, and his hands on his shoulder, like, it's so great. Oh no, here's the bad news. Poor Beta Z.
I know.
Crap.
I was wondering why it wasn't Teller, you know, like, or something else. I actually think it's kind of hilarious that it's Beta Z.
Like, oh, shame we couldn't have had a scene with Deanna getting the news. You know? Your mother was on the planet as well. She's a victim of the Jem'Hadar.
Does she come back after this? Maybe she
She ducks out of DS9 in season 4, and she was quite vocal about how Gene would not have approved of how this show was going.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's too interesting.
And her last episode is that dreadful one. Do you remember where Jake Sisko is the muse, the woman stroking his head and taking all the creative out of him? It's a really bad episode, so maybe. And the one before that was Fascination, where they had the love virus. So maybe every time Lexana Troi appears on the station, you know, the show shit
things happen. Yeah.
Okay, so now Garak is going to invent a terrifically sort of Machiavellian plan to bring the Romulans into the war.
So, is he telling the truth here? So, he says that he's contacted, like, it's pretty clear at the end. And one of the things that really works in this episode that is kind of impossible to recapture because you know how it goes, is that it is actually really, really suspenseful. Mm. And the stakes are incredibly high, even though it's all word peril. And what's at stake is the direction that the show goes in.
And we know, don't we, at this point, that events like this will have a massive impact on the show. So we know that if this goes wrong, as it looks like it does later, then the shit has hit the fan and things could be really bad going forward.
It also looks like it's going to go wrong because of what Sisko says in his opening monologue as well, where he says, you know, I don't know how things went so wrong and how I went so wrong. And watching that again, when we know that the plan actually worked, is really interesting because despite what he says at the end of the episode, at the beginning of the episode, he's characterizing this as a disaster. And I think that works.
You see Garak's face there? I don't know why anyone wouldn't trust that man, honestly. He looks perfectly trustworthy. Do you know what? He has a moment in there as well. The thing I love about Garak is no matter how serious he is, there's always a moment for a comic line. And the bit where he just goes, unfortunately, they're all dead now. Yes.
Yeah.
They're dead within one day of speaking to me. And I'm like, that is dark. That's really dark.
Is he telling the truth?
Who cares? It's funny.
No, well, that's right. There isn't a truth. I mean, it didn't really happen. That's all we have. But it's just possible that we're meant to think that he already knows what he's going to do, doesn't he?
Oh,
he
knows.
Yeah. And so he is telling Sisko that Sisko's original plan didn't work. And I kind of want to secretly believe that Garak would just, like, he wouldn't burn all of his contacts, you know, call in all of his favors on Cardassia Prime only to have them all killed. I think he would say, well, I've done that and it hasn't worked, so we'll just have to lure a guy onto the station so I can plant a bomb on his shuttle. You know?
Very, very subtle approach to all of this. Yeah. Do you know what I love as well? I love the fact that the characters on this show are so distinct that we're not there yet, so I'm kind of preempting this. But the bit where there's the recording of the supposed invasion of Cardassia is like, all we had to do was add some mutual loathing between the characters.
Yeah,
and we're like in our heads, we've seen these characters as absolutely how you would sell that scene, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, so this is the pretend plan. Yeah. And it's hilarious that the pretend plan is we just make a fake deleted scene from a Deep Space Nine episode and give it to the guy and it'll be on this, you know, it'll be on a magical rod thing that will convince everyone that it's real. And Sisko kind of goes, oh, you know, well, that's very deceptive, but, you know, we might have to go along with that. And Starfleet goes along with it. And
that, all I the don't time, like that, though. That's the one creative choice that I do not like in this episode, is that he says, oh, well, Starfleet approved of this, so I'm off the hook. So at that point, I'm like, well, what stakes are in this for you then? If this has been approved, like if this was just you doing this plan, and then maybe you had to tell Starfleet that, okay, I've done this. This is what I've done.
Yeah, but Garak presents Sisko with a plan that is bad. You know, it's telling lies to someone to get them to come into the war. And if they were found out, it would be absolutely disastrous. Mm. But it's a plan that Sisko will accept while still feeling bad about it, but one that Starfleet will reluctantly approve of, given the kind of state of the war. But it was never his real plan. No. That's not his plan.
And you know what, as well, though? I think Garak really enjoys, you know, raking Sisko through the mud. I think he gets a perverse pleasure out of making him do things that, you know, he's really uncomfortable with.
Oh, yeah. And we get it played on the same, well, on a smaller scale with Quark a little bit later on.
That's a great scene.
What I think is a great scene.
Yeah.
So one of the problems I think with this episode, though, is that this blue guy is so loathsome. Like, he's a funny
Grey Fontolar.
Yeah, for God's sake, Graython space name. And he's so loathsome. And Vrenak, Senator Vrenak, is also
horrible,
such a prig.
Yeah. And but do you know what? They're both memorable, though.
Oh, like yeah.
You know, I like this where he's like, one or two Orion's slave girls.
Some porn.
Well,
I'm going to do a porn thing
now,
for
you. I'd say, you know, how dare you cast aspersions on Sisko and suggest he wants some sex, you know, porn holodeck. But then think about Janeway and Fairhaven, you know.
That's it. That's where she fucks the holodeck.
It's not out of the realms of possibility, you know. Do you know what's the best line with Tolar? Is when Garak goes, I'll be along later to say hello.
Yes. But is that I'll be along later? No. Do you know what my favorite line is? Is where Garak says, I've left him with the impression that if he goes through the door, it will explode. And Sisko says, I hope you're bluffing. And he kind of fobs it off. Yeah. So I think the door really is rigged to explode. Oh, and given that.
like Garak just wouldn't work on Voyager or TNG, would it? He's just perfect for this show. Oh, okay, this is terrific. I like it when he goes, Quark in an uncharacteristic act of chivalry.
Yeah. Well, he was tearing her expensive clothes, I think, probably. And that's the other thing, too. Like, Tolar's so shit because, you know, he can do a holodeck program and stuff, but he's here undercover, but he still gets pissed, starts a bar fight, you know, stabs someone. Like, he's an idiot.
I do like this scene, though, where Quark is freaking loving the fact that Sisko is swerving at having to silence him.
Yeah.
And it's very honest to Odo as well, because he says, you know, as a matter of law, I will make a statement. Yeah. I understand that there's a security operation going on, but, you know, I'm a man of integrity. Yeah.
We just have to do it. Yeah. If he gets arrested, you know, if Quark presses charges, I have to arrest him. What's he going to do?
It's honest to all the characters, isn't it? It's and I think I said to you before, like, the characters are so distinct on this show now. Like, some of these episodes are practically self-perpetuating. Like, they almost write themselves. You have a terrific premise, like, we're going to bring the Romulans into the war. And then just automatically interesting things happen with those characters. You know, naturally interesting things happen with these characters with a premise like that because they are so strong. I mean, what are we now? We're halfway through season 6.
Yeah. So this scene is exactly that, because we know what Sisko's like. We know what Quark is like. Quark, maybe more than any other character, behaves like Quark in every scene. you know, I described them when we did our first Deep Space Nine episode. I said that he was like a sitcom character in that you know how he's going to react in a particular situation. And he's not a character who grows. Plenty of the others change throughout the time.
They make a joke of that in The Dogs of War, in that he goes, you know, oh, you might make Ron the Grand Magus, but this will be the last outpost of the Ferengi Empire that I recognize. Yeah. You know, I will not change. PC.
So here we get this incredibly great scene. And what's great about it is Avery's acting as well. He doesn't overdo it.
So uncomfortable, isn't he? He's fidgeting in his chair like, oh, I do not want to be here doing this, protecting that fucking arsehole that stabbed Impella.
And also he doesn't want Quark to have it over him. As well. He's uncomfortable because Quark is winning in this scene, and that doesn't normally happen. You know, normally he would shut down the request about the cargo stuff that's stuck in the cargo bay. My favorite line, though, is I think we can call that a bribe instead of a deal. I think it's so great.
When he pushes it home at the end, it's like every man has his price. And then does his like eyebrow thing. Oh, here's your scene where he's emoting to the camera now.
Yeah. And like he's overreacting to what he's had to do. It's been pretty small stakes, hasn't it? He hasn't really done
It is in terms of...
He persuades Quark not to make a fuss.
In terms of how a Starfleet captain behaves in the Roddenberry universe, it's kind of a big deal. And I think that's why this episode is a big deal. It's because it is pushing against what we've come to expect.
Yeah. But remember in the pilot, he does a deal with Quark to get him to stay by arresting, Nog or something. Mm-hmm. And, he does this sort of dodgy deal because it's not the Federation anymore and he has to kind of moderate the way he behaves in this new context. So at this point, he hasn't done anything very bad.
We talk a bit about 90s Trek music. Okay, I really love the music in this episode. I think it's foreboding and quite, but there's a bit there where he's like, and so I pressed on, and every time, you know, a new doubt appeared in my head, I shoved it aside with rationalization, and the music underscoring that is really dark. It's David Bell, who was brought in halfway through series 5, and they use him a lot because they realize, oh my god, there's someone doing something a bit different, you know, from Dennis McCarthy and Jay Chataway, and you know,
yeah look, it's still barely noticeable.
I said a word. I like this as well. This is kind of like this reminds me of those X-Files scenes down in the car park where it's like all these tight close-ups, these clandestine meetings. Again, it's not very Star Trek, is it? You know.
No. I mean they're in the turbo lift heading to Ops. I do like the Ops thing. Does Garak ever appear in Ops?
A couple of times. He appears in Ops in that one where the Cardassian security device goes off and, you know, the
Painters
are blowing all over the place.
So much fun.
The bit where he casually says here, I know what he's using it for. I'm assuming it's something to do with genetic manipulation. I'm like, oh my God, that is dark.
Yeah. And I guess the biomimetic gel thing is so that we can have that scene with Julian. Yeah. Oh, I guess also it's a prohibited substance, isn't it? He could give him latinum, that'd be fine.
I don't think a lot, but we have heard of biomimetic gel before and that it is kind of outlawed. And Oh God, do you know what? Andrew Robinson just relishes every line. Look at his face.
In fact, they're quite different as actors, which works really well because they're supposed to be mismatched, whereas Avery is very restrained.
Do you know what I like about this scene between Bashir and Sisko? And that is Avery Brooks is a very imposing man. And Sid is quite slight. And yet there's a couple of scenes. There's another one in Honor Among Thieves where he confronts Sisko and he's not intimidated by him at all. I think it takes quite an actor, you know, to go up against Avery Brooks.
Yeah, I love the way he delivers the line about wanting it in writing. I think that's really particularly good. But I don't buy this at all because, you know, they'll be mates next week or whatever. They'll have a friendly relationship and this will never go anywhere. And maybe it is a relic of the Jake Sisko premise that they originally had. This is the conflict between the two characters. I'm not sure it really properly lands.
How have we gotten this far into DS9? This is our third episode of DS9 that we've done now, and we've not seen Jeffrey Combs as Weyoun yet.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Maybe we haven't.
Isn't he wonderful?
So good. He's so great. I think Casey Briggs is kind of underrated as well. I think he's really properly good.
I don't think anyone expected, not even Casey Briggs, who is Roxanne Dawson's ex-husband, by the way.
Oh, my God. Yes, Biggs Dawson. That's right.
I don't think anyone ever suspected that Damar would have such a massive role in season 7 after. Like, he's such a villain when he starts off, isn't he? Remember the bit where Kira kicks the shit out of him in the cargo bay? he lays his hands on Xiao. No, I don't think anyone saw that coming. But Jeffrey Combs, like Andrew Robinson, like Rene Auberjonois as well, I think they can take any line and make it sing. No matter how functional the line is, you know?
Yeah, yeah. They do something with it.
Yeah. And I think that's a huge strength of DS9 is that you've got a cast of actors and primarily actors that have learned their trade in the theatre. And I think you can tell that there are big performances, you know, there's a fair bit of projection. There's a lot of character involved. You know, you skip over to Enterprise and it's a lot of made for TV actors and you can tell.
Yeah. I mean, this is virtually a play.
It's got the art show, isn't it? This is absolutely a bottle show.
It really is. So you've got these guests, you've got basically two main guest characters, and then you've got the Dominion people in this incredibly fake simulation in a tiny corner of the studio, which is where we apparently have all of our meetings, all sitting around the same side of the table.
I know you're probably gonna find me on this because I know you like the astonishing production value of Kurtzman Trek, and the fact that they can tell everything on a large canvas with amazing set pieces and blah blah blah. But really, ultimately, you do just need a really good script and some good actors and you can make fantastic television. Duet is a bottle show and Duet is phenomenally good. This is a bottle show and this is really good. You know, if the writing is good enough and the acting is good enough, you've got great telly.
Yeah. I mean, I think it is a little bit of a shame because Star Trek has the potential to put something really visually interesting on screen. And basically we're here in all the standing sets and there's one optical shot in the entire show or one effects shot. And I was actually surprised by that. And I do think this is good. I wasn't bored, but it is visually not that interesting.
I agree and disagree. I don't think we need to tell this on a bigger canvas than it is. I think they light this extremely well. There's scenes where the lighting is very moody and, you know, it's visually dull because basically the sets are pretty dull. Well, no, actually, I think they're quite interesting, actually. But
No, I think they are more interesting than a Starfleet ship is. You know, they're more interestingly lit. There's different shapes and all of that.
But you skip forward to Latter Day Voyager and they were insisting in every single episode there was a dynamic action sequence, whether it was needed or not. And so, you know, it's literally making it look pretty for no other reason than making it look pretty. It didn't add anything to the plot. There was no creative reason for it to be there.
Yeah.
Whereas I was completely invested in this, in the story, where it was going, in the characters. I personally don't need more than that.
No. And what we get on either side of it are the giant sort of war things and space battles and stuff that this depends on. And so what it is, you've got this sort of giant political thing that is going to change the way the major powers in the galaxy relate to one another, but it's all happening in this tiny room where Sisko is narrating what happened, and we have flashbacks. I mean, essentially, the episode takes place in his quarters.
It's a one-man play, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a monologue.
Well, I think they could have lent into that more. And, you know, Star Trek in this era is not very experimental in the way that it tells stories or the way it presents reality. And it would have been nice to see them lean into it. I think they go as far as they dare to. But I do think it's a bit of a shame that it goes for that. Here's the effect shot. Here's the effect shot. The
Romulan model shot coming through. Yeah. But again, we can't hear the music here, but again, the music I thought was really quite strong here.
Right.
Now Cisco is going to have to go and speak at an incredible amount of bullshit convincingly.
Yeah, yeah. I love it. So that's Andrew Robertson reacting to the fact that the pad thing comes down with nothing on it. And then Cisco looks at him, but he does a sort of big bug eyes thing to go, wait, what? You know, because he's kind of forgotten that they're cloaked or whatever.
There's a line here in a minute, right? Sorry to interrupt you, in life all the time, where Robertson says to Cisco, what is it? My opinion of Starfleet officers is so low. You'd have to work extremely hard indeed to disappoint me. Well, take out the Starfleet office a bit, but I've used that line so many times with my friends, you know.
It's I think he's great. And he's a that guy, isn't he? He's like, I think he's Canadian or something, but he's definitely a that guy. He's a super familiar face.
Yeah, but he really sort of underplays it, doesn't he? But until he gets the moment.
The great moment. You couldn't have underplayed that, but no. I think he's really good. And this line, so he's enumerating all of the things that Cisco has done after meeting him for the first time. And then he's going to do what is a very standard, very cliche joke, which is, I thought you'd be taller. But in this context with a Romulan senator doing that joke, I think that's actually pretty funny. And I did guffaw watching it in preparation for this. It was a bit unexpected. It's a little bit more colloquial than Star Trek normally gets in this era.
I like it when he's drinking the Romulan ale and he's like, I was almost convincing for a second, you know. But the real stuff forcibly opens the synapses.
Don't you think, though, that that's slightly ominous that he presents, Cisco presents him with Romulan ale that is fake.
It's deliberate. And he can absolutely spot it.
It's great, isn't it?
So we know immediately he's great at spotting a fake, you know?
Yeah. Really
I'm desperate to get to that line. I've got to do it when it comes. There are so many memes of that line.
It's really great. Oh, dear.
So right now, Garak, what, he's in the ship. Plant in the bomb.
I think so.
While they're having and these one chats. Of
them, there were some handsome Romulan bodyguards, or at least one of them was handsome, and there are three or four of them, and presumably they all get all blowed up on the ship, and Cisco doesn't seem to have any pangs of conscience about them. It's like a Romulan senator, a criminal, and, you know, the self-respect of a Starfleet officer. What about those guys?
Actually, you know, I want to talk to you about the dialogue, because we've talked a lot about kind of how naturalistic Kurtzman era Trek dialogue is and how stylized 90s Trek dialogue is. And you know my sort of preference is more towards 90s than the modern day stuff. I remember your argument was like, you know, this is made now, so people should sound like, you know, contemporary. Yeah. And I do kind of get that. But I think the dialogue in this episode is exceptionally good on the whole.
Yeah.
When that stylized, and they do it, Runmore scripted episodes are especially good, I think. When they get it right, it's really intelligent, really sophisticated dialogue, and eminently quotable, I think.
Yeah.
Think of them both as tragic victims of war. I mean,
it's sort of, it's like sitcom dialogue. It's quotable, it's funny, it's clever. And I think that Star Trek always does that. It never becomes, Battlestar Galactica has a ghost woman in a red frock. I mean, it's not that gun, is it? It's still sort of camp too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
what are they talking about now? I've lost track a little bit. Hang on.
So, well, this is Cisco standing up and telling the lie.
Oh, yeah, here we go.
Yeah, and then we go out of that scene so quickly where all that we get is Renak saying, I want proof. Then we cut to a commercial break or at least exterior model shot of the station. Now we're here watching this shitty DS9 deleted scene.
There's so many scenes like this in season 7, although I'll take out the word shitty because I just love any scene between Wayun and Damar when they're bitching at each other. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Remember the bit where he goes, so what is it? My predecessor Wayun's death in a transporter accident, and he looks at Damar straight like, it's so great.
I love how they get Jeffrey Coombs in, they kill him off, and then they decide, shit, that was a bad idea.
Yeah.
I know they'll be clones. And then they just lean into it. like they make that part of the thing. I think that's genius.
And the payoff of all of that, Wayun and Damar, when Damar defects and he takes out the cloning facility and he goes, "That I could be the last Wayun. That's why he chose that target." It's great. It's so great. Oh dear. Oh, okay. And then we're gonna cut to Cisco talking about souffles rising and not, because it's done now and you know. I think we've all had moments like this, haven't we, where we've had to do something tough and you're like, well, that's done now, this is either going to work or it's not going to work, or we'll see the outcome. We haven't exactly had, you know, the deaths of millions of people on our shoulders, you know, determined by outcome.
Not recently.
Oh really? Tell me about your past.
But I think this speech is a little bit over egged, huh, souffle. Because, you know, he quotes his father a couple of times. I don't know. I think this is kind of eating up runtime. You know, we could have seen him do it. Well, maybe we couldn't have. Maybe we need him to narrate.
Well, he's just sort of reiterating the stakes, isn't he, before we get the outcome. Have you ever had that moment where you're walking towards the door of hearing a decision that's going to be made for your future, like he does in a minute?
Yeah.
All our moments like that.
And it is that thing where he's sitting there and he doesn't know what to do. And I think that this is a really shocking moment in the episode.
What, where it all goes wrong?
He's drinking as he's telling the story. Mm. He's reiterating the stakes.
But I notice his clothes are all coming off as well.
Yeah, well, I'm in favour of that. Do you think we're meant to be surprised when Vrina?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think we are. I think but it's absolutely episode, signposted.
Like, it's supposed to end neatly, like most Star Trek episodes do, but with Cisco going, well, I had to do those terrible things. So, it wasn't all tidy. Oh, here we go. Here we go.
Yeah.
Can we both do it, please? It's a fake.
It's so great. He's so good. How else could you have delivered it? Particularly contrasting it with the incredible calm in control thing. You know, that he did the interaction with Cisco before, where he was absolutely on top. He had the upper hand. He didn't need to exercise himself at all. And then suddenly having him kind of yell out of control. And like, this is the one thing, like, he doesn't phone ahead to the Romulan Senate and say, actually, I'm bringing you the fake thing that the Federation sent.
Maybe not. I mean, that is very sensitive information. You remember when Picard used to get like code red? You need to put in a special code before I'll talk to you.
They could have done that. He could have rung it.
A funny plot hole, Nathan, honestly. Good grief.
I think plot holes are bullshit. Do you know what I mean?
What I don't like is it's like 2 days later. He goes, 2 days later, I've got the news. I'm like, he didn't tell anyone in 2 days. Like,
no, Well, he was traveling here. Was he on the way from or to Sakala or Sakara or whatever the name of the planet is and blah, blah, blah. No, on the way back. He's on the way back.
You remember at the beginning of the episode they had the list of the names because they're reiterating it here now.
It's just like, oh, there's a lot of people dead, but there's really only one person that we know slightly
friend of a friend,
vaguely.
Yeah, that's right. Uncle, what a good day. You know?
Yeah, when things are looking up.
That's how dark things have got.
I think the list of names and the victims and the people that are dying in this war, that's also being highlighted because if Sisko succeeds, that is what's going to happen to the Romulans as well. They are going to start losing a lot.
Yeah, they're joining
of
in that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there are stakes. If he wins, there are actually some fairly dark stakes because he's essentially consigning a ton of Romulans to be murdered. And we watch that throughout the rest of the series. Romulan ships being blown up left, right, and center.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, what they do say in that opening scene where Jadzia is pretending to be a Romulan is that, in fact, the Dominion will, you know, we know the Dominion is going to turn on them as well. That this is just temporary. God, so that.
This is one of my favorite scenes.
Why does he punch him? Why does he punch him?
Because he's tough. And he's hard and it turns me on. That's why.
So I think.
I love this scene. I love it. Go on.
So he knows immediately that that's what's happened. And because
did you hear his voice? He goes,
Yeah.
Excuse me.
But it's also that Garak put him through that shit, you know, like thinking that he's spent 2 days thinking that they've fucked it up and that the Romulans are going to join the Dominion.
He could have said, this is what I'm doing. He's had him sweating his bollocks off for the last 2 days.
Yeah. But what would have happened? Sisko would have made him stop.
Sisko
would have warned him. That's the point. Sisko would have warned him because Sisko would never, ever have signed up to this. And the thing that goes wrong is that once he knows that Garak's murdered these people.
You see Garak's body language there?
Yeah.
It's like
a
spider with his hands up. Like he's. Creepy as fuck. I'm taking
it. It is a bit of a shitty line, though, isn't it? Like a dead senator in the other hand. So they've got a whole senator in their hand.
I do love it, though. I like it when a plot, like a jigsaw, comes together quite neatly. And this does it all through the dialogue. And you're like, okay, so this is what's been happening.
That's all there
along.
Is in this episode.
Yeah. But it's smart, you know. It's satisfying. There we go.
And this is the thing too, like how is Sisko complicit? Was Sisko fooling himself that Garak would come up with a plan that was so easy? Because Garak warns Sisko that it's going to be a very messy, very bloody business. Mm. And then the business ends up being, we made this home movie and we're going to give it to the Romulans. And so it ends up being a bit shit.
Are you saying that Sisko was perhaps a little naive?
No, I'm saying that he must have known that Garak was going to do this. And so he comes in and attacks Garak because he's angry at himself, because he knows that he involved Garak in this, knowing that this is the sort of thing Garak does. And we know that he knows this is the sort of thing that Garak does because he immediately comes to the conclusion that the ship is blown up because Garak's blown it up. It's not the Dominion at all. And I think that's really good.
Do you reckon he spent 2 days just waiting then for like, okay, what?
No. Really, I think he spent 2 days shitting himself. And then when he hears the news, he goes, yes, of course, I must have known that he would do this. And so he comes in and punches Garak because he is angry at himself.
Yeah. And it's not like he hasn't seen what Garak is capable of.
No,
in Broken
that's right.
Link, Garak's there trying to access the torpedoes to blast the hell out of the changeling planet. You know, he's willing to commit genocide. Like, it's not like, you know, it's a great secret that Garak's capable of doing terrible things.
Yeah. I really like this too. And this final scene where he says that he can live with it and absolutely doesn't convince us he can't live with it, because he says it twice and then he crosses his leg and looks really uncomfortable. Yeah. And it is, it's very theatrical, isn't it? Like, it's very kind of,
I think that's why I like it, you know.
Presentational.
I love
me
it.
Me too. Yeah.
Yeah, look
I
at him.
Too.
No, he's a bit camp, actually, isn't he? He's a bit camp with his head. Look at that cushion he's got. Good
yeah,
grief.
It's pretty.
The only bit of colour in his
if
quarters,
they had a cushion
I'm
like that. And there he is deleting the episode. And we go out immediately after he finishes that line. I think it's so good.
I want to very quickly just make a comparison, because you and I watched Strange New Worlds from Enterprise Series 1.
Yeah.
That came after this. Okay. That was broadcast okay. after this. And we struggled to find anything relevant or substantial to talk about. Now, that episode we just watched, now we didn't agree, we didn't like everything. We both agreed it was really, really good. But there's so much to talk about. There is so much substance in this show at this point.
Yeah.
With the characters and with the running storyline. And that's what I think DS9 brought to Star Trek. Just a kind of like a weight of detail and substance and interesting ideas, you know.
So what I like about this episode particularly is that it's invisible to everyone else. The only people who know what happened are Garak and Sisko, and the war changes. This is now a war they can win, and all of that happens in this episode that just takes place with just people talking in rooms on this far-off station, and no one ever finds out. And I think that's really interesting, but I think that the problem is, and it's worth paying the price, I think. The problem is that we never see the effect that this has on Sisko as a person, the fact that he's crossed this line, because this episode takes place in this tiny little kind of bubble narrative. There are never any consequences for him.
Would it surprise you for me to say that I both agree with you and disagree with you? I agree with you insofar as within this episode itself and like the following episodes, there are no real consequences. And that, the sort of having a closed episode like this where he deletes it at the end, that's the point, I think.
I agree.
This season, and I'm including In the Pale Moonlight as part of the jigsaw this season, has a profound effect on his character. And at the end of the season, he heads back to Earth. He resigns from his position. He's lost Jadzia. He's made lots of tough choices. And he's on Earth scrubbing potatoes in his dad's back alley. And he's like, I've just had enough of this now, you know.
This episode is one of the things that he's escaping from.
Like a contributory factor. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very, very quickly before we choose the next episode, the next episode after this, is His Way. So that's the episode where Odo and Kira get together. It's a romantic musical comedy set in Vic Fontaine's 50s lounge bar.
Is it the first Vic Fontaine story?
The very first one, right? And I'd say it's as accomplished as In the Pale Moonlight, but as an example of how diverse DS9 could be, to put this episode and that episode back to back.
Yeah, that's confident, isn't it?
That's very confident. To switch genres like that, yeah.
Yeah. There's just one more thing that I want to say, right?
Hit me.
That one of the things about the Deep Space Nine war arc is that it repeatedly makes the point that all of your egalitarian, peaceful, socialist ideas are good in theory, but you really need to abandon them in order to actually survive. And that's what happens here. That's what's behind Section 31, you know, the idea that Section 31 exists outside of the Federation.
Spreading its claws into Kurtzman Trek.
Well, and but that's, I mean, America is a bit like that. America thinks of itself as peace-loving and committed to justice and all sorts of things. And we know what America and other Western countries do to the rest of the world. And so there's a sort of realism to that. And if the Federation is America, and often it is, I think, then maybe that stuff's worth investigating. But I have to say that Discovery Series 1 poses the same question.
And it goes the other way.
It does. It says the only way that we can properly make this war worth winning is by sticking to our ideals. What's the point of winning? What's the point of mere survival? Like, if we betray our ideals. And the idea is that they're going to blow up the Klingon homeworld, and it's Georgiou's idea because she's from the Mirror Trump universe, and they reject that idea, and it comes out well. And this is a made-up show, so they could have done that. They weren't committed to making that point. And I have to say that I like the way that Discovery Series 1 does that more than I like the sort of grim conclusion that we just have to be evil in order to survive this war.
I think probably the Discovery, that's the more likable approach to this. And it's the, like, you know, what we should aspire to.
Yeah.
I reckon, like, if we look at history as a whole, this is the more realistic and probably the more compelling, because is kind of throwing shades on how people behave. Then there's a great line in The Dogs of War, just as DS9 went out, where Odo says to Sisko, when he realizes that it was the Federation that poisoned the founders and tried to commit genocide. And he says, it's fascinating, isn't it? Like, you're willing to portray this fabulous utopia, but when the dirty work needs doing, you'll look the other way. That's such a great line. I love that line.
Yeah. And I think that that's good. I mean, that's a thing that this show exists to do, is to interrogate the Federation and therefore perhaps America. And it's a perfectly legitimate approach. It's a good thing that you can do with the Federation. It's worth doing. Maybe it's a personal preference.
You just don't like it as much. Yeah, well, that's absolutely fair. Well, yeah. Interesting. I think this is the episode that's pointed at as criticizing or exploring the alternative to the Roddenberry ideal. I don't think this is the episode that does that. I think non-fan favorite Valiant later in the season, which literally has idealized Roddenberry-esque cadets in charge of a ship going like, we can do anything, we're Red Squad, you know, and they're absolutely, you know, TNG episode season one characters that are like, they're going to go out and civilize the universe, and then they're all murdered horribly at the end because they overstretch themselves, and actually they come up against a force that is more powerful than them, and it's horrible, and it's, I'm not sure if I like what it has to say, but as a way of confronting that ideal, it's absolutely gripping.
All right, I am open at untitledstartrekproject.com/randomizer, and we are going to pick our next episode, and I have control of the button.
I am powerless and riveted to find out how you are going to play this time.
Okay, I'm leaving it completely open because Well, I'm being daring. I'm going to turn the films off, even though the chance of a film is pretty slim.
Oh, man, I'd love that, though.
How secretly few there are. We should do a film sometime soon.
No, because we'll end up with bloody Generations or Insurrection or bloody the motion picture.
Nemesis. You know? Oh no, we have to do the motion picture. It's awesome.
The motionless picture.
The motionless picture. I am going to leave Star Trek The Animated Series in because, again, I think the chances of us rolling one are fairly slim. And this does bias things in the favor of 90s Trek because most Star Trek at this point is 90s Trek. So let's see how we go. I'm pressing the button. Oh, Jesus.
Oh, no. Christ. What is it? Is it really terrible?
It's a first season Star Trek The Next Generation episode.
Oh, yes. Go on.
It's The Last Outpost.
Oh, awful. Oh, I'm almost
it's
tempted.
So boring. Yeah, I'm tempted too. Wig. Riker shouts into a, oh, my God, it's the first Ferengi episode.
Yeah, it's Alan Shinman doing that kind of weird acting.
Is someone else in it?
No, Max Grunchick's not in that one. I can't remember now.
He's really in the battle or something, isn't he?
It's so awful.
It's so boring. Okay. Too boring.
Do you want to do a different one?
Yep.
All right.
Oh, do we want to do another Deep Space Nine so soon? This is Dramatis Personae.
Oh, that's awful as well. Roll again.
Oh, okay. Oh, is that series one?
Yeah.
That's series one. I do remember that
one. It's the
one
where Kira's coming on to Dax all the time to try and get her to go evil with her. It's very weird.
I think it's like a retread of Power Play, isn't it?
Not as good, though. That has Marina Sirtis going, everyone get down on the floor. That's great.
Oh, dear. Okay. All right. Now, we have a rule, which is if it's a two-parter, we have to do two parts.
That's right.
If it's part of a larger arc, we don't have to do the whole arc so that we don't have a 10-episode.
Like you're preparing me for something here. Come on.
It's season 2, episode 2, The Circle.
Oh, DS9 again. I don't think we should do DS9 again, you know.
Okay, I'm switching it off. All right. That Hope Is You Part 2.
The hell was that?
The season finale of Discovery Season 3. So the first episode of Discovery Season 3 is called That Hope Is You Part 1, episode
That's very,
one.
Very sneaky.
And then episode 13 is called That Hope Is You Part 2. So we wouldn't have to do part 1 and part 2. We would just do part 2.
I've not seen the latter half of Series 3 of Discovery, so I would be quite intrigued to watch that episode.
Okay. All right. That will be interesting.
What's occurring in the end of Series 3 of Discovery?
They discover the source of the burn.
Oh, the thing that set off all the dilithium.
Yeah, that kind of destroyed the Federation and made everyone kind of isolated and mistrustful of one another.
Is it a satisfying explanation?
It's a strange explanation.
Mm. And has that been revealed before the finale?
No. Okay. This isn't part two, but as usual, the end of a Discovery series is quite highly serialized, so we will have to kind of fill people in on where we are at this point. But I think it's worth a try.
You're going to have to fill me in. I've not seen the latter half of that. See, I might watch all the ones I haven't seen. I stopped at the Mirror Universe episodes. Is that far from the end?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay, I'll watch a lot then.
Yeah.
Discovery again and Series 3 again.
Brilliant. Listening to Untitled Star Trek Project with Joe Ford and Nathan Bottomley. You can find us online at UntitledStarTrekProject.com, where you can find links to our Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube channel. Our podcast artwork is by Kayla Ciceron, and the theme was composed by Cameron Lamb. This episode was recorded on the 7th of February 2022 and released on the 18th of February. We'll see you next time for Star Trek Discovery, That Hope Is You Part 2.